14th, 1996. I'm with Boynton, Colescott, Maricopa, and we're at David Becker's studio outside of Montora for part two of our interview.
Well, after our last interview, David sent me a one-page statement expanding a little. He had some second thoughts about some of the conversation and wanted to clarify a little. And so perhaps to get that material into the tape, David would briefly look over his letter and add anything that he feels.
Yeah, because I think we were talking something about, you were asking what was it about Madison and something special about Madison. There's some kind of a lure there.
Yeah.
And I was trying to go back to, it all linked back somehow to student days and then really had something to do with the people on the staff who I had as teachers and then eventually who I worked with and then people who I came to know here. And I was thinking back that in Milwaukee when I was a student there, I had Bob Burkert, who of course was a student of John Wilde, and I think he would refer to him. There was some, you know, close linkage there. And then Joe Freebert, who then I later understood had a pretty close connection with Zingali. And that the Madison Art Department actually started out in Milwaukee, I think, or didn't it? There were early years, I think. So it seemed like there was some at least philosophical connection. And while I was a student there, these people always kind of gave me a good feel, or supported what I was doing. But in grad school, there I didn't have that kind of support. If anything, it was kind of probably indifference.
At Illinois.
I'm pretty sure the kind of imagery I was trying to do was seen as a little strange, maybe just weirdo stuff.
Yeah.
Not concerned with formal issues, that sort of thing. I was just sort of a lack of that. But nevertheless, I did get a teaching job.
Yeah.
I got to Detroit. But then I was thinking all the years I was in Detroit, first time I was in an exhibition, the first faculty show, the Detroit News art critic thought my paintings were emotional catharsis, and then wondered what I taught the students, and I thought, God, that was a big shock to me, because I had never thought of that. And then the painting faculty there thought I taught students to paint little green men, and then the department, these are all comments, made over here. Department chair thought I did sickle stuff.
Did he tell you that?
Indirectly. I was making a joke someday about a sculpture commission that it was a little black humor, something about the police and fire commission. I suggested some big casket or something. I don't know. Because there was so many cops being killed in Detroit, and he didn't preach my sense. He said, "No, I'll leave that sicko stuff to you." Then people I taught drawing with, one guy thought I was stuck in the 16th century. And then when I really got going into prints and having some success, then one of the other painters asked me one day, "Well, David, are you still doing new old prints?" Little sly remarks. So I get those kind of comments. And then when I really wanted to teach printmaking, then I thought I was some kind of a specialist. So I was eager to come to Madison when the opportunity arose. Or probably too eager. I mean,
How did you respond to some of those charges, to your accusers, at least to yourself? Did you think about that?
I sort of enjoyed the outsider status. I just felt totally alien to the Detroit art world. They had their own kind of shtick there, I guess. I kind of laughed it off.
In general, you have a pretty fair ego, don't you? I mean, a safe ego.
Yeah, I thought it was strong. They weren't going to kill me. And I was getting in these shows, and when you actually got reproduced in Art News magazine, so I thought that wasn't the same guy that thought I was doing new old prints showed me the magazine, so I knew he was impressed. So, I guess my ego was strong. I could laugh at it. So. But I never thought of Madison being that way, see. I mean, it was famous as, obviously, in the print world, famous for that. It didn't occur to me. So I know this Warrington was here, and then and John Wilde, and then and you guys all did kind of strange imagery. I mean, it was the sort of thing that people I worked with didn't have a great deal of respect for. I knew that, and Gleckler and Meeker, I figured, you know, he was had to be in that line of thought somehow. So I thought there was a whole tradition here that I could relate to and respect. Yeah. So I was thrilled to come here. Yeah. So that was that. Milwaukee almost hired me, but fortunately,
yeah, that was interesting. That was interesting.
Yeah,
that
was
I didn't know that.
You didn't know it, yeah.
No. But you were very close to being hired at Milwaukee.
Yeah, well, Bob Burkett called me up. He said, you know, it's Friebert's old job. Why don't you apply? I said, gee, I hadn't thought about it. I don't know. Because I had written a letter asking, when I saw the position, I think I heard from John Colt, the essence was basically don't bother. We're, you know, we don't want the inbreeding kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, so I won't apply. And then Bob said, no, there's some people here. I want you to apply. So I did. And then I later found out I was the committee choice, but they performed a little parliamentary maneuver and killed the position, which left me rather bitter. And the next year, they hired a student of mine from Wayne State, as a matter of fact. She was very talented. She was a young Polish woman, but she was pretty good. But they let her go eventually, so she must have had her problems.
You probably wouldn't have enjoyed Milwaukee.
Well, in retrospect, I'm glad I didn't go there, but I had this, I wanted to get back to Wisconsin. We had this lake cottage up north, and I had this great idea of spending weekends on the lake, and I'd teach in Milwaukee, you know.
It's pretty good.
But, so it, you know, fell through. So that's that. So. How I got here, hired here, I don't know. I mentioned in my note that Fennell remembers the faculty meeting at which they voted life drawing number one, and said her jaw dropped. She couldn't understand why these guys do that. What was it?
Well, I think it was the prestige of John Wilde, his teaching in life drawing, you know. And I guess he and Grilly had concentrated on that. And so the teaching of life drawing had prestige behind it. Mm-hmm. Even though it was also seen as out of the contemporary loop. A lot of people who questioned it.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah, and yet they had to admire the people that came out of it and the way they worked with the other offerings of the department.
I think
it was mainly the real substance that Wilde had, I mean, his personal success and his work with students. So that we were definitely wanted to keep that going. We wanted to keep a position in life drawing. And so we not only got to hire, but we got to hire at tenure. And in a way, we wanted to find someone who we could put up a very good argument to hire at tenure.
Because you hadn't done it before.
We had never done that.
Yeah.
We'd always hired in the basement, sort of, which worked out fairly well in that they would, their careers would develop and they'd go through the various promotions. But it was clear that we were going to lose a lot of staff. We had an aging staff and we were going to have lots of losses. So I certainly felt that we needed to bring people in at tenure and really substantial people.
So when you came, these people you're referring to really had retired or were about to, and so you were part of the...
No, what people you mean?
Well, Warrington and Wilde.
Yeah, well, Warrington was still teaching, was close to retirement. Wilde
had
well
retired.
Well,
Wilde had just retired.
Yeah.
Or he, I think we were able to initiate the search knowing he was going to retire. I don't think he took any part in the voting and everything, but it was his job that he was being replaced.
Was there a sense of change in the air then as a result of your contact and others who were coming in at the time, so you're
well, just, I got hearing me, or?
Well, just in terms of the feeling within the department.
I don't know. I took me a while to figure the place out.
Yeah.
I mean, when I got here, there was some resentment I had about who I was. It was Lauderman. He's going to have to share an office with me. So he was bitching about, oh, I'm going to share an office with this guy. And then I heard about this other guy. Yeah, it's just what we need, another old white guy. So there were, it was a mixed reception,
yeah.
I think. Yeah, there. As far as I could tell, I thought the print manufacturer were happy to have me. And there was mixed feelings from the painting and drawing faculty.
I guess.
Some resentment, I think.
Yeah. It really wasn't apparent to me. I think I was in charge of the search committee. And it seemed to me we had pretty enthusiastic response. You really were, there was no doubt you were the top candidate. And the committee, you gave us a lot of names to get letters from. And that was very impressive. You know, I think I got
the outside letters.
Outside letters, and you had a great variety of people, well-known people. I think the only letter I didn't get was Harold Altman.
Oh yeah.
Who I phoned him up and I tried to get a word or two in, telling him, you know, that we needed this letter for you, and that you thought that he would do this, and in the meantime he was telling me how much money he was making, that he was now a millionaire.
Uh-huh.
And that he really liked his sixth wife. And he never did. He said he would write a letter, but
yeah.
He never did.
Well, I didn't have any. I just thought, well, we had traded prints at one time and you were looking for names. I thought, well, yeah. If we traded prints he might put in a good word for me. But that's,
he did verbally. A few short sentences.
Yeah, but as it turned out, I guess he had enough.
He had a new studio in Paris, and his securities were doing well.
Who is he, just for the record?
See, nobody hears of him anymore.
No one really sort of knows him anymore. I think he became so commercial that he left the art world. He really turned a pretty good talent into, he ran it into the ground. He had very few ideas, but he did have a style that was very successful for him. Now you find his work in frame shops and so on. He's
doctor's offices.
Yeah, he's been grinding about. He sells. Fanny Garber has a show of his about every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Usually sells out.
Usually figures on park benches in Parisian parks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's some little figure walking down some tree-lined lane.
Just look through that big bin of prints. You'll see at least a half dozen of them.
Yeah.
All
sorts. Yeah. You would know his work, I'm sure. He was on the staff at Milwaukee. In those days, we would meet with the Milwaukee people about once a semester, and everyone was presenting ideas and arguments, and Altman would be in the back just drawing. He would bring a really nice paper to these meetings, so that anything that he did during the meeting, he could turn over to the gallery.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could go to the record now and start looking at.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, what do you want to do now?
Okay, we're going to.
The starter print was that one there, frame that, that's the one I was talking about. I got me going in 69.
So, in 69, you were at Wayne.
Wayne State.
Yeah.
Painting and sort of getting interested in prints.
Yeah. And now, the earlier prints that you had done, did they look like this? Were they related to this?
No, not really.
This was a new departure.
That was a big departure, yeah. Earlier ones were a little more kind of semi-abstract.
What caused the departure?
It was the painting, really, yeah. The kind of paintings I were doing were going in this kind of direction.
From what baseline? What were you doing before? Abstractions?
No, it was figurative, but kind of semi-abstract, figurative. Late 60s, I was getting into more of the this kind of Renaissance landscape. Or the last, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
What do you think was impressing you at this time? It has the look of Northern Renaissance paintings.
I really think it was the influence going over to Detroit Institute of Art.
Yeah.
Hanging out in the galleries.
The museum.
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. Italian painting, too, but yeah. Tight structure.
And
figure compositions.
Where did you go into the print room? Or into the drawing collections that they tried, or?
Not much,
this was really, what was out in the gallery?
What was hanging on the walls, yeah. Their print collection, they had not yet got the gallery they have now where you can see continuing exhibitions. And it's somewhat autobiographical. I would pose models in my life drawing classroom in this old barber chair.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The barber chair
yeah. That came to subject. And I threw a self-portrait in the bottom.
Yeah.
Ways.
So you were using models,
well,
but you altered their aspect.
Models out of my head, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So I really wasn't looking at models particularly. And, you know, things are all out of scale, and I was just happy to kind of put things together and fill up the space and get it to kind of print room.
This is a... What's the brand? Etching?
No, it's an etching, yeah. That's actually in the Union collection, so
yeah,
they bought it out of one of those salon
chairs. There are two of your things up on
yeah,
the walls.
That one and there's another one there that's hanging in the theater.
Interesting, yeah.
that was stolen years ago out of the Union and showed up a few years ago in this antique shop next to Andy Balkan's
really?
Print shop. He said, called me up, he said, David, there's this old print of yours in frame. So I said, what's the number of it? I said, that was stolen out of the Memorial Union years ago, so they called the Union over there, and they got it back, so.
For the record, what's the name of that? What is that print called?
Landscape with 17 people in one balloon. I just counted the figures in there, and then the balloon was wound up looking a little bit like a prophylactic.
Yeah. Or an internal organ.
Or something.
Or a breast.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So there was a lot of sexual stuff going on in there. I was having a lot of fun. And it's hiding little messages too. You know, I put my initials there and I wrote F on my other side. Or you are a SOB.
What's the FY stand for?
The what?
FY.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
So I thought a nice thing about Prince, you could do that kind of thing. Messages.
What was influencing your technique at this time? This would seem to be stipple etching.
It was hard ground, straight hard ground etching,
uh-huh.
And engraving. Uh-huh. One thing I did learn how to do when I was in grad school, learn how to engrave, but I basically learned it off a competitive book. I just followed the instructions in there, and I got kind of good at that. So
it's a mix of etching and engraving. And you would etch and then deepen it with your Buren, or?
No, I pretty much etched what I could, and then I would strengthen maybe contours, or these are all like little engraving, those marks. I got that from just looking at old prints, you'd see.
Yeah, the two things, they really fit together. You're really not, you don't have a separation of technique. It's
no.
It's all of a piece.
Yeah, it was sort of back and forth.
Yeah.
It wasn't really predetermined.
Well, last time you talked about the danger of reading one of your pictures. Obviously, what we've been doing is reading this in our conversation here, and bringing our own experience to it. Is that sort of what you hope you get in terms of the viewer's response?
Yeah.
So each of us reads that in a slightly different way.
Yeah, probably. I mean, if I had to figure out myself where the images came, part of it, like trying to figure out how to do a wall, so I'm looking at a basement wall, and then trying to get a distant landscape in, and self-portraits, and then a lot of little goofy kind of little sexual imagery, mm-hmm. tubes, and
Now, at this time, there were a multitude of print shows, exhibits, competitive.
That's when I started sending seriously. I had sent through grad school and gotten some of the shows, but I didn't start seriously until I did this print. And then I was surprised. I got some purchase awards.
It was a successful
print. I
like
this, yeah.
Yes.
And I only did 30 of them, and got rid of most.
Yeah. So this is the last copy?
Yeah, I don't even think I have a number.
I mean, a copy that in your possession.
It's the only copy I have right now, yeah. I never did any artist proofs or anything.
Yeah.
Once in a while, I think I should maybe print some artist proofs.
So you still have the plate?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You don't?
Sits in the drawer.
You don't resell your plates?
Do what?
Scrap them.
No. Gosh, no. But after all I put into these things, I was long liking the plates better than the prints.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I get so tired of printing that I enjoy selling them. I don't keep them all. I keep them too. So, I tend to sell the plates for scrap.
Okay, that was the next one. That's the one that's
that's
up in the union.
Now, what kind of paper are you using generally?
Well, I used this BFK for a long time. That was another Reeves. Well, that's BFK too. Yeah. But for the most part, I just kind of use one paper. Mm-hmm. And this one got a little more organized. It started in the same piecemeal fashion when I did a self-portrait. Then I added my wife, then I added my kids. And then I was trying to kind of figure out if I would start inventing these figures. And then the landscape, and plus the, this was taken out of a painting I had done.
Where did this idea come from, the trolley?
The trolley was from a painting I had done of a figure pretty much like this, just hanging from a wire, and then one student told me one day, you know, it looks like a barn trolley. I didn't know what barn trolley was.
It's called A Tremble in the Air.
A Tremble in the Air, which was, I just lifted that off of a play I had seen one time or something. And then I wanted to put kind of an emotional word in there, so I'm all carved in.
These recognizable people beside yourself here?
Yeah, well, this, I tried, I had my wife pose me and my kids. I couldn't get them posed too long, so I used a photograph for that. And these were just kind of doing stuff on the head.
Why did you put yourself in on both of your early?
It's probably just the best model of it. I think part of it was just the challenge of trying to do it, get myself in there. And it made it a little more real to me, I think.
You've said before it takes you a long time to do something.
Yeah.
So, how many months does this require?
Well, this was under 2 years, but...
The thing that fascinates me is this
tell by the dates.
Detail on the trees and the brush, much less the figures. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you achieve that? I mean, that's...
Well, this was all stipple etching. It was all done, except with some engraving of contours.
But I mean, it's... lines here with the trees without leaves on them and so forth.
Yeah, all done through a hard ground, and I was getting into magnifiers at that point.
And what kind of tool would you use?
Just a good sharp dental tool, sharpened to a point. So I was doing trees without leaves on them because they're easier to do than trees with leaves.
True.
Yeah, I mean, you can get in as
quicker.
And this was outside my basement window. And it was the leaves were falling at the time. I thought, well, that's convenient.
But would you work from a photograph? Because otherwise, this proportion.
No, these I could kind of invent.
Invent, okay.
I used to like these trees that Bob Burkert would do. He do these silk screens with these Wisconsin landmark landscapes, and I was kind of admired it. Probably gave me the idea.
Yeah, that is a kind of Burkert tree.
Influence there.
Old Wisconsin school leafless trees.
Leafless trees.
Don Anderson, Greg, that was one of the things that really struck me when I came here.
The school of leafless trees.
The school of leafless trees.
It's a good title for a print.
Yeah,
it's very cool.
Oh, it might be the title for our book.
Yeah,
we're still looking for it. You're stippling, that's through hard ground.
Right? Yeah, again, trying to think, was I using liquid or? I may have been into the liquid hard ground by that time, yeah, because I've had a lot of trouble with re-etching. So
now, something like this, would you use a straight edge?
I'd lay those lines in. Over the, say if it's an area like this, and then just lay in a network of lines, kind of organized it. So that worked pretty good.
So yeah.
It reminds me of somebody one time said, we know you have a big castration anxiety. We know what those scissors mean, don't we?
Well, actually, I just throw away. Yeah, there's scissors. Besides, I'm scared of knives, so I thought a woman holding big scissors was some deep anxiety, I guess.
Well, the subtlety of the textures here is very interesting. Did you really try to work for that?
Yeah, I was trying to get it a lot finer, you know, a big jump from that one over there, which was pretty coarse. So I was getting better control over the etching ground. So that got fairly fine. I was doing all the little pieces, you know, I'd etch in the canteen that I'd etched a shovel in, and it was all done in little sections. That's when I was doing these island, because I was scared to death I was going to false bite an area. But yeah, I know if now it's liquid ground, because you can see the streaks. Mm-hmm. Very subtle streakiness of the brush marks there. It would etch unevenly.
All from the liquid ground.
From the liquid ground, I was cooking my own using, I misread that recipe in the Petardy book. Where it says benzene, which is supposed to be benzene the naphtha, and I was using the benzene up there at the top of the hydrocarbons, which is carcinogenic.
Well, they're really poisonous.
Really causes leukemia. I would stir this up over a hot plate in my basement, holding my breath, and sort of exhaust fan going on, and I lucky I didn't blow somebody's up. But it evaporated real fast, that's what I mean.
That's right, some people use gasoline. You know.
Gasoline?
Yeah, but in England we use gasoline.
Really? No explosion?
And everybody's smoking too. All these cigarettes dribbling.
Okay, so enough of that one then? And the next one I think was this one. This is one that's in the Walker's book. Dark time. So
does the
Albium?
Does the Albium have any of these?
Trying to remember the. No, not these early ones. No, they got I think two later ones.
This really looks Flemish or Northern European. Is that?
Probably.
Something you're working towards there.
Not really consciously. No, I was just trying to get the figures to look right, and. Wind up this way.
We're getting some leaves in our trees.
This was tough doing those leaves. I had a hard time. Damn, leaves are hard.
Yeah.
Looks like you're getting a hold of yourself.
Getting a hold, yeah. A little peeing in the woods. This was supposed to be kind of a combination etching press and meat grinder.
This is called In a Dark Time.
In a Dark Time, I lifted that title off a poem by Theodore Rutke, who I guess he was a Michigan poet
one time,
and then he moved to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought it was a good title.
State of Washington.
The State of Washington.
Yeah.
I thought it was.
It's interesting that you haven't done that many etchings, but. You created a kind of sensation in the print world. I mean, you really got a lot of notice.
For a few prints. Yeah.
For a few prints.
Yeah.
I mean, you really established yourself as a printmaker, sort of top of the line. Because the number of prizes, for one thing, I mean, you not only got it shows, but you won a great many prizes. And I think at that time, too, prints were very competitive. There were a lot of first-rate people making prints and concentrating on prints.
Didn't you say it was more like artists were judging your shows? More
and, right, the juring was done from within the profession.
Yeah.
So most of the shows, there were artist juries, one-man jury, three-man jury, but most of them artists, which I think is a much superior way than the way they judge now.
Even when there were curators, though, I was thinking of people like Alan Fern, so it seemed like people who were steeped more in the
who
whole
were
tradition
really
of printmaking.
Into
were not into contemporary theory, let's say.
Yeah.
That, at least that was sort of
yeah. Well, I think so. I think that, you know, in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, early 80s, was not a piece of cake, it was a very high.
Okay.
Would you draw this out completely before you began working on the plate? Or?
Actually, this was the first one where I did do a small sketchbook compositional study. Up to that time, I just sort of putting stuff in as it went along, so this has got a little better organization. So this idea of a tube kind of bisecting, that was sort of kind of initial primary to begin, plus the procession.
So at any given time, how much time would you spend working on the plate? And would you come back to it periodically, or would you just...
Well, it's all I would do. I mean, I would just, spend my work day working on the plate. Oh,
okay.
So it was one plate at a time?
One plate at a time. I'd be etching in all these little parts and then getting it all to fit together.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to the point where I could scrape out things. Like this head was totally scraped out at one point, and then I redrew the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see a depression on the plate, but I was sort of taking pride in the fact I could do that and match it back.
Yeah.
Right. So that was kind of a technical problem.
Yeah, that's the question I was going to ask. How much was the finished plate, how much did it reflect the initial drawing that you made for the plate?
The initial wasn't a complete drawing, it was just a small study, and I added other figures. The only thing that was in the original one was the procession and that and that.
So the figures developed as the plate developed.
And then I would sort of figure out how to do the landscape as well.
Yeah.
The only thing that actually existed was this tree, which was on the road.
So you're not doing any painting at this time? You're just doing
I found I couldn't do both one time.
Mm-hmm. How many hours a day would you work on something like this? I mean, I know it varies.
Well, obviously, it was a non-teaching day. At that time, I was probably 60 hours. Kind of trying to set a work ethic up.
And you'd work on one at a time.
And I'd be doing these sections.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And then I keep thinking, I wish I could, like, figure out how to do more of these.
Yeah.
So I'll have it made. I can really get a reputation going if I get a whole bunch of these things.
You couldn't bring yourself to, say, put that aside and to begin to develop another one.
I'd think about doing it, but I couldn't do it. Absolutely could not do it, dude. I just have to stick with it. So.
Yeah.
Is there a time of day that you generally work on things, or whenever you could?
Sometimes I'd be working late at night, other times early in the day. Those were days when I was sometimes working late at night, and I'd pull a proof, and my wife would be up in bed reading. Come up with a, look at this! What did I do? Wait a minute! Now it's pretty good. I'm proud of that reading.
Were you still working in the basement?
Still in the basement,
So you didn't have a nice window to look out?
No, I spent 15 years in the basement. When we built this place, the guy doing this asked Pat, can I ask you a question? Why don't you make those ceilings so high? I said, because my husband spent 15 years in the basement. in the basement. Okay.
Yeah, it probably had something to do with the tonality, maybe, in that one.
I don't know. This is interesting thing, just in the printing thing. When I printed the edition, I did double runs on it. And it never blurred. I never understood why. And it was on this old Norwegian press. And then when I got the brand and I tried doing that, the darn thing, I'd get a double image.
Then you'd get a
darn thing was working great.
Would you have one of these magnifying devices on a lever or something like that?
No, I had one of these. Yeah, you've seen these magnifiers that
right.
Yeah, I've got a whole bunch of magnifiers. I had those that go down in sort of a shield. I have some that clipped on the glasses. Okay. I tried all different ones.
Yeah, John Hulley uses that too.
I have ones that sort of hook on the bridge and kind of stick out and little. So they really work. Okay, this was Bob. Another self-portrait. And that, again, started from this sketchbook drawing.
Union Grove Picnic,
inspired by the institution in Union Grove.
Developmentally disabled, I guess
right.
You call them.
Right around that time, well, it was sort of like a Diane Arbus photograph a little bit. Some of the characters kind of reminded me of that. Getting more autobiographical, but what I did at that time was I would scrounge stuff from my life drawing room from a government surplus, and I'd always come up with neat things. Once I got a whole pack of Army surgical drapes, and had this hole cut in the middle for the operation. And I would use these for a model of drapery material. So I just strung these up in my basement studio. And then what I liked about it too is very much, there's this, in the background of this Bruegel painting, The Wedding Dance, way in the background between two trees is a cloth strung up, and it looks like there's a hole cut out in it. I think it's some kind of a latrine. I'm not sure. But I would look at that over there instead, and I liked it. So I thought I'd put it on. So that was sort of a reminiscent of Bruegel.
Yeah. Now you're getting fancier in your etching.
Yes, I'm doing a little, I'm using a mezzotint rocker to rock over some of these areas and a roulette.
It's sort of white on dark.
I was painting, I'm sure I was painting out a little bit. And I also was getting into, I was getting into sandpaper aquatint in this. So this grainy texture, that's all done with a burnisher. And
sandpaper.
Pieces of sandpaper, I put the sandpaper down.
And all through the ground.
Although this was all stippled. Yeah, and this is my body with an indented head.
When you say stippled here, each of those...
It's all done by...
By hand.
The human hand, Which is what I was proud of the previous one. I thought every mark on this thing was done by the human hand.
There's a little tool, a stipple tool.
Just a point.
Like a hook.
No, it wasn't. No, this is just through the hard drive, just through my dental tool.
Oh, just with your regular thing, with a stipple.
No, my hand would be going automatically.
Yeah.
So as a result, I can't keep my index moving. It goes up in the air when I'm trying to do with that. So.
It's a great face.
So.
How long did that one take?
Oh, that was, when I finished that one, I started on this one. I don't know, it probably went close to 2 years ago. I was sort of on a two-year schedule. I would, I'd get one print done, and I'd be sending out to these shows, which would keep the resume going during that, while I was working on a new, and when that sort of ran dry, I would have the new print done. And I kind of got content with that for a while.
Did you ever use some of your proofs, say proofs before you were finished? Did you send any of those out?
No, I never did.
You wouldn't put it out until it was really done?
I would send early proofs out occasionally. By that time I had this little gallery in New York and I'd send her a proof.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was in John Zocchi by then or not, maybe, but I would send him early proofs, Franz Bader in Washington. And I guess that may have helped sort of drum up a little business, possibly. I don't know. They would show it to some
there's
a few collectors bought a couple of early proofs, but that was,
there are people interested.
I always thought it was kind of fascinating.
Sort of working proofs were sort of finished.
You did all your own printing.
Yeah. And then for each of these prints, I got like a stack of proofs like that in the drawer. A zillion of them. So.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of fun with this.
Well, I had a Wayne Thiebault catalog that, for a show just of his proofs. And he got tired of having all these proofs in the drawer, so he spent time taking them out, painting into them, altering them, and so forth. And so then he had to write an apologia for this, you know, the fact that he was making things, single prints, out of all of these proofs. And it's very good reading. I mean, he really makes a nice case for working over your proofs.
Well, let's see, this was 2 years later, 77.
What's the name of this?
This is entitled Last Day. This one I was trying to get more reality into it. So the landscape exists. This is a gravel pit, this is Highway 70 going down. Well, you know where out of Monaco. Remember those cabins you were thinking about? A cabin up there once, like an old resort?
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the resort, but that was Highway 70. You follow it down that way. And then I was trying to imagine an aerial view of this gravel pit without seeing it from there. And then the I had improvised it down.
You seem to like figures suspended in air.
Yeah, that came out earlier. No, not really. The floating figure,
This.
I don't think I have any real clear insight. I think it's a real interesting image. Either to have the figure floating or naturally suspended,
Do you have a fear of heights?
Probably, yeah.
That's just what I was going
to ask. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Well, what about being in the basement, I can understand.
Yeah.
You know, if I go down to Chicago or you walk across the bridge to Lyric Opera, and I have to stay near the center line while Pat's walking. Over there. She's getting nervous. Yeah.
I think that might have something.
15 years in the basement, this person could be claustrophobic in here.
Yeah.
That sense of claustrophobia is not.
Well, I had this psychiatrist who I would see for these those sessions I told you about. And this is the print he hung in his office because it generated a lot of
conversation.
Yeah, it was like it was a great conversation starter. Mm-hmm. He said, "Oh, this is obviously a self-portrait." Just so all constricted, being taken somewhere against my will across this landscape. So that was. And that was, again, there's some real slight streaks in there. You can just go on across on the liquid hard drive. But for the most part, all stippled and sandpaper aquatone. Then we come to, I finally tackled a bigger plate. This was the one I was working on when I was here that year.
Right.
You were gone in 78, 79. I was kind of, I finished it that year here.
Yeah. Yes, I remember you working on it in that studio up on the fourth floor.
Right.
The name of the thing?
The name of this print is Monuments.
Yes. See that?
Monuments. Kind of monuments to a lot of things. And this was another sketchbook. Actually, it started with the idea of a 19th century monument. That's out of a Detroit 19th century cemetery. The name on the monument was D-A-M-M. But that changed it. It was sort of like the earlier print that said death. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Not
a self-portrait, but I was kind of going through political difficulties at Wayne State, being stabbed in the back, so I thought, I would do a self-portrait from the back and then just sort of stab the canvas. And this is my homage to abstract painting. I thought, well, I'll rip that up too. And then I was always worried. I thought, I'll put painting away forever by turning this canvas to the wall and slashing it.
How about this little debris?
This is kind of studio stuff. I mean, this is, I have this Duchamp urinal and a studio chair, a bunch of motors. It was kind of interesting doing a pile of debris. These were memories of the Wayne State Med School. Mm-hmm. I take students to see things like that. I was putting that all behind and more trash. Floating figure again, I'm not sure what that's all about. I thought of this figure as sort of the angel of death. The crowbar lift you up.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. This is sort of a, well, it's kind of like a Renaissance crucifixion scarecrow mm-hmm. image combined, a little autobiographical elements. This is my grandfather's stainless steel beer peel. Which he had custom made to go to railroad picnics in Milwaukee, so I thought that was pretty good. Which was actually my taping bucket for taping down prints. So I put these little elements in.
When these are reproduced in a publication, you must lose a tremendous amount of detail.
But there's been some pretty good reproductions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it depends on who's doing it and how much,
what the budget is,
how much they're spending on that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly possible to get beautiful black and white reproductions. Yeah. You don't see that very often, but it's possible.
This got a lot, reproduced a lot in catalogs. Some of them were pretty good and some were pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, some print catalogs, you know, they would really take great pains with the reproductions. And I can think of a number of yours that were reproduced beautifully.
Is there something called a duotone process?
Or yeah.
Where they get a
duotone.
Higher quality?
Well, yeah, where they actually work from two plates. They print them in sequence, so it's not just one half tone plate, but it's two. Maybe one's a half tone, one's a line plate.
Okay. And that gives you a great
clarity,
right?
Yeah, we did that on the New American Graphics. That was all done in duotone, and we got very fine reproductions.
Hmm. Okay. You on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's see. So that was 79, and this is 81. See, we're on the 2-year cycle still. And this one, I thought I wanted to try a square print, or almost square. It's actually 23 by 24. And then also, what I was trying to do on this one was to do a straight engraving. So I started off with these figures just totally engraving right from the start. And as time went on, I realized I was going to have to switch over to etching. So.
The title again?
This is entitled Right Turn, because these figures have come in this way, reached the wall, and made a right turn. Zipped out. It's also probably my divorce print. I made the right turn.
Engraving being dry point, is that what?
Engraving is cutting all these lines with a engraving tool directly on the copper.
Right.
So I had pretty good control over it at that time, but it was, you know, it was kind of crazy doing that whole hand with straight engraving. So this was sort of a destiny figure, I think. That's odd, you know, doesn't this look like a cool green? That's a warm, it's almost like two different, it's a strange illusion.
Yeah.
This looks like a cool green, it looks almost like a warm yellow.
The white comes out in the engraving, the white and the softer tonality versus the more
etched areas.
Yeah.
Now this building here, I'm pretty sure was influenced with the education building.
Mm-hmm.
That studio you were talking about, I would look out my window and notice those windows. Those windows.
You could see various wings up from up there.
Yeah, and that's memories of that.
Now you were printing yourself. What sort of ink were you using?
I was still making my own ink, but in fact, here I got that.
Nice. Okay.
I put down my 4-lamp black tubine, 1 burnt umber. I was mixing.
Did you always use your own ink?
Yeah, I had been making my own ink right from the start. I learned it in grad school with Muller and all that.
Yeah.
And this the
former Lisansky student had convinced me that that was the ultimate superior ink, was to make your own ink, so I thought that's what I have to do.
Well, that's right. Yeah, so all right,
you had all that benzene lying
around. Well, I was also, that's true. Well, I was also still very stingy at that time.
That's the main point.
The cost of the ink, and I get the pigments free from school and this stuff, so I mix the stuff.
Yeah, we used to mix our own inks. For a while we were mixing all the inks, and then that got very hard to keep going with the students. Then we just we mixed our own blacks for a long time. The assistant would mix up enough for the class to use. More or less how we did it.
Eventually, everybody just.
They had more money than time, and so we began to go to 514.
I thought it was part of the process too. I enjoyed making my own grounds, making inks, everything from scratch. Stubborn and clumped.
A stupid question. This isn't a parody of Richard Nixon, is it?
No. Actually, that would be two things. Yeah. No. Actually, that idea started with coming back from a summer vacation in Maine and going through Rochester, New York, in August, at which an Oktoberfest was being held downtown Rochester, New York, in a tent. So there was this strange. While we were at this table, this bunny dance started. This is downtown Rochester, which sort of looks like downtown Detroit, but all the people there looked like they came in from the hinterland. There were strange looking people, and one was this slightly retarded young man who got up and started doing this dance, and pretty soon a bunny hop started, and they were snaking and being led by this guy. So that kind of gave me an idea, I thought, sort of his family. Leading the free
So these are your prints. There's this a hint of being in an asylum or some kind.
Probably. Life is an asylum. I say sooner or later I see people on the street that kind of look like some other people.
Exactly.
So that was my adventure into street engraving. Didn't last too long. Okay. Things are starting to drag out a bit now. This is, that was 81, so this is 84. I was working on that print there, and then did this one. This was a print commission from Detroit History.
Cross pants
was that bridge. Right under the bridge.
Now, did they print the edition?
No, I printed the edition.
You printed it.
Yeah, I was gave them the plate, had to cancel it. And they never were able to sell it.
Really?
Well, they would do this annual commission.
Yeah.
And then they'd sell them to the members, I guess something like that. I guess they'd all sold them out before. And the curator at the time was Marilyn Sims, and she was writing articles for Pratt Graphics Review, remember that? And then she left there and went to Toledo as a curator. Last I heard, she was at Cooper Hewitt, I think, in the American Journal of Prints. But she got me the commission. She admired straight black and white prints, etchings.
Yeah.
And I don't think the membership took any more. In fact, it was just a few years ago, we got a call in the office here from the curator at the Victoria Institute of Arts wondering if I objected to their selling them at any price or something like that. I think they still had some left. They were trying to get rid of them. So, they were their prints.
Yeah.
They paid them. So. What they did with them, it's their business. But I had to, I did this one in 6 months. Game, but I had to take some shortcuts, so I didn't fill in the whole background. And I tried to use atmospheric perspective, so I fade that stuff out and kind of mist. And I was drawing, this is all drawn through sandpaper, that whole landscape. And with this stuff being straight hard line etching. So I didn't do a lot of changing on this one. I did a complete drawing, transferred it to the hard ground, and then stipple etched most of it. I don't even think I did any engraving on this. This is a straight etching.
And you were teaching life drawing all along?
Yeah.
Would you show any of these to your students?
I would do some life shorts for my classes, show them the prints and stuff in progress.
What was their response?
They pretty much, I usually got a very positive response. This is the only one that came from a specific dream. It was this big shovel. This one I started in Utah. Marcia Smith had me up there in summer of 81. This is soon after my divorce.
And I was this.
What?
What's the name of this?
This is entitled A Foregone Conclusion. So the landscape is the Utah landscape up there in the valley near Logan. Buildings are kind of reminiscent of Detroit freeways, where you
sort of building left here.
A few buildings. Yeah, it's kind of inspired by that. Yeah. The bridge idea. And actually, this idea comes from my bicycle trip to Eastern Europe. When we crossed some old bridge ahead, we had to sort of negotiate the planks falling off. So. And this was my great. Love interest.
Uh-huh. In Madison or Logan?
No, in Detroit.
Oh, in Detroit.
Yeah. So she's a model classroom, so I was, this is the first time I did any straight from life, so I made preparatory drawings. But this big thing is scaled down using they call it a method. Gridding off. So, trying to get everything just right. So I was pretty happy with actually how the figures came out. This self-portrait here, I had to completely scrape out at one point and then redraw the whole thing back in because it was up too high. It wasn't sitting in the landscape. But this stretched out endlessly. It looked start to finish by the 4 years. It's crazy.
Had she come and gone by the end?
She was gone by the time the plate was finished, and the title turned out to be prophetic. There was a foregone conclusion. So I had it all figured out after I did it. We have this self-portrait here, who's tethered, and is being restrained from this enticing figure here. And then here, the back is turned to me. And I'm the Janus fingers, the mask looking backwards, I'm looking to the future, and I'm imagining I'm going over this landscape. So I figured out, I'm making a trip, heading out through the composition.
You've got rich material here for a video. If you really got a good video to go through the prints as we have and to, so much detail. That the video can go in and wander.
Yeah, where you get that sense of movement and story kind of
going. Yeah, have some poetry in the background. Yeah. I can see a great video here.
It's almost like mythic
secondary income.
Mythic proportion of some of these things. Yeah. Journeys and the.
But I have to just from a drawing standpoint, I really want to prove myself like I do some figures from life. So.
Yeah.
But then I never really wanted to do it again after that.
Certainly looks like a Logan.
Did you do any studies of the landscape when you were
No, I didn't. It was just out of my head. And then I had this elaborate system. I had this notion of overlay of lines. You can see all these diagonal lines. Once I had stippled this all in, I wanted to get it darker, so I had it methodically laid in all the lines, and then I would stage bite the lines, I was trying to get it to read so you wouldn't even know the lines were there, unless you thought about it and looked carefully.
It really seems like a Utah print to me. I mean, it's not only that you've caught the landscape, but there is something about the curious sexuality there, the repression, the sort of general repression.
Yeah, you hear stories of
that. Arrogance of their beliefs and the kind of wreckage that they make, that are made out of all of this.
It's a strange place.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
This tape is just running out. I'm going to turn
it. Okay.
Okay. No, I had finished this print just as I was moving to Madison. It was interesting. I think I was so frustrated with spending the amount of time on this. I was ready to give up printing. I thought maybe now's the time to sell all my equipment, make a fresh move to Madison, and just start painting. So. And then Andy Balkin, who I'd known since 79 when I was here, steel-faced it and then printed the edition for me. And so he was getting better prints than I was getting, so I was real pleased with that.
What was the largest edition that you made?
The largest one I ever thought I was going to print was that hanging figure at 139. Mm-hmm. I was selling my prints at the time, so I thought, well, I'll do 100 plus my age. So every new print, this will be a hidden code for my age, so that was going to be 130. I never got past 80. But the largest that I sold on was 125. Mm-hmm. That was on that Union Grove. Mm-hmm. That was mid-70s. Yeah, that was when, you know, people were buying prints.
That was a good market.
Yeah. So after I got here to Madison, my first couple of years, I was more involved in drawing. And then I was trying to figure out how I could get these prints done without more directly. So this was as a result of doing a fairly careful drawing on Mylar. Actually, I did one drawing, and then I did Mylar over the top and redrew it carefully, or more carefully, and then had it shot on a laser scanner over at this Sporlace Color Graphics. This is about with the research grants, stuff that I'd never been able to do back in Detroit. And then I was working with Andy Balkin, and he did the photo etching. And when I pulled my first proofs, I was such a disappointment because the whole thing just had long, it went flat. It was so much, it was such a fine screen that it printed almost like a lithograph. And I lost all kinds of detail. I had to rework the whole thing with the hard brown and gray. And then Andy steel-faced it. I think this is one of the ones he printed.
This is called Exit.
Exit. Yeah. For the record, kind of has to do with there's a figures entering to the left, and then we have an exit here to the right. Well, actually, what I had intended here, and this is, I was going to have a two-plate etching. One was going to be just the figures, the other one was going to be all the supporting walls, floors, the background. And I was thinking a two-tone black and white. Like, due to what was going to be a cool black, and then it was going to be warm. And I thought I'd be able to do all the careful photo etching, and then in case I screwed up on these areas, I'd have that on a second plate. Well, I got exhausted. I ran out. I thought that's it.
Who is the central figure here? Is that just...
Well, as I get into my...
Looks like Dick Cabot almost.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, he's wearing a jeweler's eyepiece. This, as I interpreted this afterwards, this is God. This is fate. It was always got a little, laughing. This is the angel of death again. It's got a little skull on her majorette hat, which is, actually this figure kind of relates to this other relationship I have with this woman in Detroit.
Yeah, the face looks familiar.
Yeah, she was a photographer. Mm-hmm. So she became the angel of death. I don't know about this guy, another little sexual event going on here on stilts, and then we have this grouping of figures, which I'm not entirely sure what's going on, obviously, this is the being introduced here.
And a chorus.
Yeah. Maybe he's exiting over there, I don't know. Maybe this is all about life. So, and I was trying to kind of think of perspective view. As you might see through a wide angle lens, and you have the
vertical stuff. This is different paper.
Yeah, this is Somerset. Yeah, it switched, actually, it switched over to Somerset with that print too. It's getting better. I haven't really used a lot of different papers to get something that worked well in them.
They hold up really well.
Yeah. I think the Somerset's a real good, tough paper.
But if you showed at the Milwaukee Museum, they still wouldn't give you more than 5 lumens.
5 lumens?
Lumens. In the lighting.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Still pissed. In other words, it works on paper. They have categories of lighting. Rules.
Oh, so even though the stuff will take good light, they won't.
Certainly, even though your paper would stand up to daylight for a while, certainly this kind of light. And museums just more and more underlight anything that's done on paper. It's outrageous.
Being super cautious.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyhow, so that was my disenchantment with the photo etch process. It was terrible to print that plate. Just getting the white areas.
Yeah.
Andy was printing, called me up one day. He sounded totally frustrated. Dude, I can't print that. I can't get the white areas to. And I don't know, he did something again.
Andy.
That was in that first portfolio we did.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. And
that's
this was taken out of a section of a larger drawing, actually.
Yeah.
I had this drawing, you may have seen it.
I've seen it.
It was in a faculty show catalog, originally. Yeah.
I think that's the first work of yours that I actually saw.
Okay. What I did on this one, I did a pencil drawing. I had this pencil drawing, I had it photo etched. We did a line shot over at Master Blueprint, and Andy etched it in the plate, and then I worked back into it with the hard drawing. It was okay, I wasn't really that happy with it. It got a little coarser than I wanted, and it was kind of a tight.
It was very successful.
Yeah, I think.
It was called light rail?
Light rail, yeah, a little tongue in cheek. This is. This actually has something to do with a play written in the 70s called Steam Bath that was aired on PBS. And in the play, God is a Puerto Rican bath, steam bath attendant. You ever seen that?
Bruce J. Friedman.
Yeah, it's great. I'd love to get that.
Bruce J. Friedman, isn't it?
Yeah. And I read the screenplay a couple of years ago. It was very enjoyable reading. So this kind of crazy machine is there. Just trying to get ahead. Fab
humor.
And that, I was working on this at the same time. Well, Andy just printed this for me, so I'm thinking I got it too dark. Oh, do you think it was too dark to me?
It looks a little darker than I remember from other copies. Dark where there's a lot of work.
It's too dense. Yeah, he was real proud of it, but I'm looking at these and it's kind of clouded up with ink.
Yeah.
Real happy with the work. But anyhow, this was my last
print. This is the Hamady print.
Yeah. Inadvertently.
Yeah.
there's
So.
It's Walters.
He's been doing too much color lately. Speaking of frazzled.
I saw your proof, and you don't know all that you're working on.
I don't think my proof gave him that much trouble, but the Wearsome, I guess he had a lot of trouble with the addition of the Wearsome.
Yeah. What's the name of this one?
This was called Redemption. There were Hitler televangelists here doing that.
What is the...
Well, you know, this relates to that earlier print with the wine glasses on a tray. I think it's the destiny figure in the packing crate.
This is the most populous of your
prints. The most figures.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got the most figures in this one. Mm-hmm. And this I had a complete drawing for on Mylar. I basically followed it just as drawn.
But you drew, it's all drawn into the ground.
This is all hard ground, you know, engraving. Yeah, I didn't want to do any floor. I went return to, I thought I was redeeming myself by going back to the hand methods. Part of the title. And the trees in my backyard. And
these look like Syrah figures.
Oh, really? Oh, with a hat in it.
Yeah.
Oh, that could be the afternoon. Yeah, this was, I was thinking of this. Perhaps it was South Port.
My ground shot.
Yeah, right, that kind of hat. Both of those picnic hats.
But they're close.
The angel of death has reappeared this time. She's got a little wire hook. Safety pin.
Dangerous.
When, after I was doing it, I actually started looking like my ex wife.
Spa. I went to
the spa.
California.
What's following?
I played with Geyser. Oh, I went to one called the Golden Haven. And you take the mud baths and you bathe in the mineral waters, the hot mineral waters.
It's like a European spa.
It's fun. Lots of massages.
The only spa I've ever been in was in Czechoslovakia. It was a spa for elderly arthritic people who come in from villages. It was very strange.
Did they get in the water and preach to you at your spa?
I know you went to wine tastings later. This is where it was a California spa.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it's good.
What else can I say?
Marvelous Prince. Marvelous
Great
Prince.
Prince.
Yeah.
Doom and gloom and fire and what
have you. Yeah, well, that's the best stuff.
We'll try to interject a little humor here.
And calling for interpretation.
Yes.
Calling for involvement.
Right. These characters keep coming back to you. I just keep coming back to this person, to the angel of death. You just don't really believe them very easily.
Yeah, I know it seems strange, but working on this for a long time, I feel sort of like I'm familiar with it, and I don't get that tired of looking at it.
When you've exhibited in the Madison area or in Wisconsin, what sort of reaction do you get? Are there people that object to your frankness of the figuration? Your nudes have genitalia, they're real.
I don't think I've noticed much, or at least I haven't been around if there's any comments. I don't know, I guess I never really had any problem there. I'm sure the only time I ever had anything overt was years ago on a faculty show at Wayne State. And when I was still painting, somebody wrote shit across the painting. So I was able to clean it off.
So
I didn't know if it was common on the imagery or whether it was just on why are you doing this ridiculous thing on the painting?
Well, was it Dewey he was talking about having an experience where somebody defaced his stuff?
I think he did.
I think it was.
And then there was a show in the Alpheum of German Expressionists, which raised a great outcry. They had to take a few of those out of the show.
Out of the German Expressionists? They had the Otto Dix prints?
They had Otto Dix, Gross, and so forth.
Yeah, and there were some Otto Dix, there was a suicide print. And
right, and they took that.
I surreptitiously was taking some slides, and then this guard got after me. But this is, I was traveling through Madison at the time. They took that print
down?
They
took that down.
Oh, okay.
They were.
And I think the hanging figure had a heart on even in the...
Yeah. It was a suicide.
Suicide, yeah.
And, he had genitalia in a state of suicidal excitement.
That's interesting, so they took it down.
So it's hard to tell what will set
people off. You don't know what people think. That very first print over there years ago, I remember I took it to a Detroit photo lab and I wanted to have some prints made. And they told me, well, we don't care to photograph this sort of thing. And I didn't understand what was so bad about it.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to photograph it. You think I was bringing in child pornography?
Printers are very impressionable, I think. Printers and photographers. And they're called upon to report certain things. If there are children in them, God help fathers and mothers these days that to photograph their little children in the nude.
Well, we worry about that as well. So we haven't taken nude photos, no photographs as well. For that very reason. Even their grandmothers.
You'd be running a terrible risk because they are required to interpret what they're doing and report it.
See, I always thought, in the print world, that there was this whole tradition of image that, you know, wouldn't raise eyebrows.
Yeah.
Much. At least the kind of audience, the crowd that looks at those places.
Yeah, but it's a tradition, but you have to take your chances. You have to follow what seems right to you.
Is this your last etching?
That was my last etching, yeah.
And then this is next?
Yeah.
How do you deal with the scale here? Do you have any problems at all?
No, I've been pretty comfortable.
This is a painting. We're moving to the painting section. Just make sure we've got plenty of room for you.
Is this the one that was in the back of the show?
Yeah, I had that one. I've really been working on it. So
yeah.
You can see I'm doing painting I did on print when I was sort of hoping that these next ones go faster. No, I enjoyed the scale. It seemed real huge at first, but then it doesn't seem so large anymore.
Yeah, two of you.
Is that oil or acrylic?
No, it's oil. It's oil. I'm trying to avoid any no fancy mediums, just straight turpentine and tube paint. And getting more actual objects in there. And I'm not sure where this is all going. But I find I'm enjoying it a lot more. I just like the whole physical movement.
It's hard to tell how much you're going to develop it. You know, I mean, if you're going to develop it to the extent that you develop your prints, there's probably quite a bit more to go.
Yeah, right. Well, these figures are pretty much finished, and the building's finished, and the color's not right in there yet. And I'm painting this one. Now, this figure's pretty much finished. But the landscape elements, and I started to paint those figures in up there. The drapery is pretty well finished there. But it's getting more complex than that, just finished.
Now, a lot faster with this?
Well, I was initially. Yeah. I was going real fast initially, and then I started getting more detailed and wanting to get more detailed. And it's just from the left over to the right, it's a little tighter. At least the figure seemed more challenging. I seem to be able to get veins on the surface and things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm getting fascinated with all the surface. Totally practical. I don't know what to do with it. Hang off my wall.
Do you have a name for this?
Yeah, this is Empty Every Night.
Oh,
yeah. It's the printmaking, yeah. Whatever the waste can. My link to printmaking, I guess.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of fun painting guns and chainsaws and fun things.
Right. What's the pistol? That's
it's a Colt Python 357.
I knew it was an exact.
There we go.
Can you see a possibility that now that you're in painting, that you could then carry a work on a print as well as a painting? In other words, to turn from the painting occasionally and work on a plate, and then to turn from the plate and work back to the...
I heard a talk about that idea a little bit. Danny's been telling me about this drawing on glass process.
Yeah.
Development.
Yeah.
He claims I'm really going to like it if I... Andy Balkan.
Yeah. With some, a printer like Andy available to help with processing the plate.
Yeah.
And with printing.
And where I wouldn't have to get bogged down.
Exactly. Where you would just do the work, the plate work.
Yeah.
It would seem to me that you could carry it.
Very direct.
As someone involved in prints, I think it's, I can see your painting, but it saddens me if you stop making some prints.
Well, it ties in also to the idea, I would like to insert with the idea, it looks like large charcoal drawings. Mm-hmm. and then that'll tie in with perhaps some print forms.
Yeah.
I'm influenced an awful lot by what I've done in teaching over the years. And I've always been pushing students to do the big drawings, and occasionally I do some kind of demonstration drawing. Yeah, that's not bad. And I think, why am I not doing anything like that? So that's a, you know, kind of tied with the larger scale. But then if I could, I don't know, if I could actually do that, I mean, pull off a print real directly. And,
yeah.
I think, yeah, it would be an accomplishment.
But there's help now.
With some help,
ease,
yeah.
To ease the process a little, right. And to sort of free the creative part of it somewhat.
Yeah.
I mean, Balkan really is a fine resource.
He's really committed to
He is a great printer. And I was just working with him for 2 days this week, and he picks up on what's needed immediately.
Yeah.
And JD really wipes the plate.
So that would be an intriguing idea.
Yeah.
But I really thought of that whole relative is traveling kind of range.
Yeah, well, I can see that.
How many prints have you done? Have you seen them all?
We've seen them all, except for one small one.
How was that?
That's crazy.
Well,
really?
Yes. Incredible display. Mm-hmm. Better to have that many in the level that they are, as opposed to a lot.
I suppose, if I never had a teaching job, I was working all day long. But then I never made a living off it. I wasn't doing any of it. So. And the luxury, I guess, of the university as the patron of the arts. Mm-hmm. I was living that long for a long time. Still do.
You know. It frees you to do exactly what you want.
Right. And I felt I haven't compromised with imagery at all. I thought, you don't like this stuff, you know. I'm trying to reach standards, at least formal standards.
If you look at the prints that the publishers are turning out, you know, they are so decorative, and so many of them are kind of mindless and trivial. They're trivial stuff.
Even a guy like Peter Milton, who he was very respected at one point. There's a recent full page ad that John Zilke took out of his latest edition. It's fashionable.
Yeah.
It's technically very impressive, but it's kind of second, you know. That's, I guess, what you have
that's
to do.
That's the usual pattern.
Yeah,
that's the usual pattern.
I mean, he's always gone around with Harold Altman, but not quite that bad.
Yeah. Well, that's the woodcut guy in California, too. The same, the color woodcut, I can't think of his name.
Wesselman?
No. He does landscape, sort of colorful. Anyway, he was another one that has always made a living on his work, and the work initially was very fine, and then it's less fine and less fine, and it really becomes commercial as he started playing more and more to his market.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure years definitely when I did that one print, that foregone conclusion, I remember I was stopped in to see John Zilke in New York. Show him the finished print. Well, David, this print is going to be very difficult to sell. And if I was dependent on sort of thing, I probably never would have done the print at the end.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done an imagery that's going to raise some eyebrows. I mean, the print obviously generally makes people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say. It's understandable. Getting almost too private there. Although my lawyer hung that print on his office wall.
Lawyers are.
He was a good
guy. Yeah, they're good.
Right next to his plaque that says Sue the Bastards, and he had those. he had that print hanging on his wall. I mean, that's kind of my price of work. Paying him with work, too. So, there it is.
Well, where are we? Are we really finished? We might be finished.
I think so.
Sort of sounds like that.
this is it.
Yeah, I think we will now, I don't know what we'll do, but something else.
We almost don't even want to shut off the tape at this point. We got so many good things on it.
Now you're going to be listening to all these tapes.
Oh, we have been. We have been listening to them.
As a matter of fact, that covers your last interview for you and for Warrington.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that you listen to this stuff and then you just start to get ideas how to write things down.
Well, we also get a transcript of most of them.
An index, yeah.
Yeah, an index. Mm-hmm. An index so that you can then hone in on a particular part of the tape. Mm-hmm. Tape is kind of gridded. But actually, the tapes I just played with one of my player in the studio while I'm doing a studio day.
I listen to them and transcribe segments of them verbatim in the areas that I think I'm going to use for the writer. Then I write it up and then I share it with you and Warrington.
I see.
Or edit and vary it or listen over. So we get a text. But it's not a literal transcription of everything that's said, but as Warrington said, and Barry does, we make